Okay, I'm giving everybody a bonus because, well, I did the work for it already. I actually did two more episodes than I needed for this month's Potoween because I'm bad at math. This is the horror of being bad at math, kids. So what we're going to do to cap this all off is we're going to cover briefly all of the Goosebumps we didn't get to from the original 62 in the series, which is a lot of books, so let's just get into it. Number 5, Curse of the Mummy's Tomb. Gabe Hassad is spending Christmas vacation in Egypt with his Uncle Ben, Uncle Ben's, they never turn out well, and Cousin Sari. He is invited to explore a tomb by his Uncle Ben, an excursion on which he gets lost and encounters some of its ancient residents in the form of mummies. I kind of still can't believe, from that episode where I read reviews of this book, that someone used it in a curriculum for Egypt. I can't be totally sure, but I have a feeling the finer historical details here are a bit, let's call them, elastic. Number 6, let's get invisible. Max and his brother, Lefty, find a mirror in the attic that can turn its users invisible, but the more Max, Lefty, and their friends use it, the harder it becomes to return. This has a great title, and I can't help but sing it like the Let's Get Dangerous theme from Darkwing Duck. I mean, being invisible forever wouldn't be great sometimes, but overall, I don't know. I think you could get on disability. And as a person who doesn't traffic in his looks, and for whom this situation of not trafficking in his looks gets further and further from even possible the farther time goes, being invisible might actually be to my benefit at some point. 7. Night of the Living Dummy. Lindy Powell finds a ventriloquist dummy in the trash named Slappy and keeps it, prompting her bratty twin sister Chris to get one named Mr. Wood as well. However, when destructive pranks begin happening, the sisters begin to wonder if their dummies have anything to do with it. This is the book that really launched a lot of the aesthetic of Goosebumps. Slappy is kind of the breakout star, the Urkel of this whole affair. You know what's funny? Slappy is always wearing that same suit, but you could change the clothes on a dummy pretty easily. Slappy could wear, like, anything. Why not, I don't know, a beach outfit or something? 9. Welcome to Camp Nightmare. Billy Harlan is staying at Camp Night Moon, turns to horror. Okay. Billy Harlan is staying at Camp Night Moon, turns to horror when word of the monster Saber lurking in the woods crops up, followed by a series of events leaving campers injured and missing. Camp is definitely the classic horror setting. Probably because there are like a million summer camps, and if you shoot in like April, you can have a whole run of the place, right, for your movie. Is that why Jason haunts camps? Because it's the cheapest place to film since someone invented the woods? 10. The Ghost Next Door. Hannah Fairchild is startled to wake up from a horrific nightmare of her house burning to find that the empty house next door has suddenly been sold as if overnight, and the son of the family somehow has the ability to survive a series of near-fatal accidents. After she investigates, Hannah discovers to her shock that Danny Anderson might be a ghost. A mysterious shadow follows her throughout the story. Does it count as a discovery if the discovery is something that might be happening? That seems more like a theory than a discovery. I might be burning up the podcast charts right now, and that statement doesn't seem to rise to the level of discovery in my mind. 11. The Haunted Mask. Sick of being the butt of everyone's practical jokes and appalled that her mother made her a lame duck costume for Halloween, Carly Beth Caldwell decides to buy a mask from a strange costume shop. But the more Carly Beth wears it, the more her personality changes and the harder it is to take the mask off. Well, maybe it's not such a bad thing. Like, what if Carly Beth's kind of a bitch? I know the message of kids' books is be yourself most of the time, but like, if yourself sucks, maybe being the haunted mask is a better option for everyone involved. More murders, but like, less, you know, nitpicking. 13. Piano lessons can be murder. Jerry Hawkins and his parents, Mr. and Mrs. Hawkins. I'm going to assume that Jerry Hawkins' parents both have his same last name, unless you tell me otherwise. Have just moved into a new house where Jerry finds an old piano in the attic. Mr. and Mrs. Hawkins decide to put the piano to good use by making Jerry take lessons, but Jerry discovers a disturbing truth about the piano and the insane piano teacher who just loves Jerry's hands. I was planning to read this one and ran out of time, mostly because I took piano lessons, and they did, in fact, suck. I read that R.L. Stine was originally intending this book to be about guitar lessons, but piano is by far the better choice. It's a stupider thing to take lessons for. Not because it's stupider, you probably have to learn more music to take piano, but because what kid in his right mind is going to take piano lessons? You'll never get a kid to enjoy that, so you might as well at least throw a guitar his way and maybe he'll get some chicks or something. He probably won't, though. I feel like guitars are kind of like expensive cars. They really only attract other dudes who are into expensive cars. 14. The Werewolf of Fever Swamp. Grady Tucker and his sister Emily Tucker, again, do I need the last name? Have moved to a rural area in Florida near a swamp notorious for werewolf sightings. When a strange dog becomes Grady's new pet, the entire town suspects the dog of being the werewolf that is terrorizing the swamp. The name Fever Swamp is very questionable, but I recently found out there's a Popelick Creek in Kentucky, which houses a Popelick monster, so what the hell do I know? 15. You Can't Scare Me. Two pranksters team up to scare a fearless girl named Courtney in the town of Muddy Creek. When all of their pranks backfire, they decide to use the local swamp, said to be the cursed burial ground for the town's original settlers who died in a mudslide and were reborn as mud monsters. Muddy Creek is a better creek name than Popelick, at least. Seriously, can you imagine telling people the creek in town is named Popelick? How is that even possible? If I ever achieve my dream of making a book tour up for myself that goes to the stupidest name places I can find, you can bet Popelick is on the list. 18. Monster Blood 2. Evan and his friend Andy once again contend with the evil novelty slime called Monster Blood. This time, Andy is revealed to still have some of it left and accidentally feeds it to the class hamster Cuddles. Our first squeakquel. I was about to say, how do you accidentally feed a hamster monster blood? But like 4 days ago, I was scrolling Instagram and came across an account that was showing off a bunch of different slimes with like glitter and different colors in them and stuff. And honest to God, I thought it was a food. I thought that enough to ask Poonmaster Flex about it, and she still thinks it's funny that I thought it was a food product because food is all I think about. It's not funny. I have a disability. Deep Trouble. On a vacation in the Caribbean islands of Elandra, Billy Deep is rescued from the jaws of a great hammerhead shark by a mermaid who is targeted by Billy's uncle Dr. George Deep for scientific experiments about rare sea life. Mermaids, huh? I don't know if mermaids have any place in these books. They're a little from what I understand and just want to be a part of our world. But it's generally not like a big problem or whatever. Are mermaids evil anywhere in fiction other than in pirate stories? And let's face it, if mermaids were killing pirates, they're kind of doing positive vigilante work on the seas, right? Is killing pirates, you know, luring them to their deaths? Isn't that kind of just like, you know, being a sea cop or something? 20. The Scarecrow Walks at Midnight. While visiting their grandparents' home on the farm, Jody and her brother Mark discover that the farm is haunted by demonic scarecrows brought to life by a farmhand's black magic. If a scarecrow is scaring people, does it become a scare man? Surely someone has made this joke before, but have you heard it before? That's the real question. In the internet age, you can Google just about any joke and probably find it, but if you're the first person to hear it, and you hear it from me, I get the credit. That's the new rule. 22. Ghost Beach. The Sadler siblings, Jerry and Terry, try to solve the mystery of the ghostly resident living in a mountain cave near the beach. Calling your beach Ghost Beach would be a good way to make a beautiful place sound less attractive. Like, they should have called the most beautiful neighborhoods in California shit like Fever Swamp and Shithole Swamps and just plain The Swamp. 23, Return of the Mummy. A year after his previous encounter with mummies, Gabe flies back to Egypt to attend the grand public opening of the pyramid his Uncle Ben was excavating last year. Gabe and his cousin Sari soon find themselves trapped in the pyramid, and the news reporter they trusted named Neela soon reveals that she is not who she seems as she wants to awaken the mummy of Prince Khoru. Do pyramids have grand openings? I'm sure that if one were discovered, it could eventually open to the public, but do they have like a ribbon cutting, a mummy wrap cutting, people with pyramidal balloons, a sheet cake, four sheet cakes leaned in on each other to make a pyramid? You know what? Now that I'm thinking about it, I think I could throw a pretty good pyramid grand opening. 24. Phantom of the Auditorium. Brooke Rogers and Zeke Matthews were chosen to play Esmeralda and the Phantom in their school's version of the Phantom of the Opera, but a chain of accidents impeded production and threatened to have Zeke kicked off the cast. There's an entire musical and album based on this book, and I considered listening to it for this month, but I just don't have the tolerance for that kind of thing. I mean, we're just replacing opera with auditorium. What kind of uncreative person would just do a send-up of Phantom of the Opera for a book or for like a month-long Padawan? 25. Attack of the Mutant. Comic book addict Bradley Skipper Matthews finds out his favorite comic book supervillain, the Masked Mutant, is real, but a visit through the lair has Skipper losing his grip on reality after seeing comic book panels with himself as the hero. Yeah, no. I mean, let me tell you, I read a lot of comics as a kid, and I never confused myself with a comic book superhero. That's not a thing that happens, because if it was going to happen, it would have happened to me. I was the prime candidate for that sort of thing. I was the kid on the beach getting sand kicked in his face. 26. My Hairiest Adventure. Larry Boyd freaks out when his hands become hairy, presumably as a result of expired tanning lotion. Things get weirder when his friends begin to disappear and dogs who share their physical features appear in their place. Very obviously about that old rumor regarding jerking off, bumping the old goose, as they say. You know what's funny about that rumor? If it were true, everyone would just have hairy hands. And not everyone does, so therefore it can't be true. In fact, wouldn't you know someone who had hairy palms if this was true? Like, if this was true, wouldn't one fuck up who couldn't resist have hairy palms? 27. A Night in Terror Tower. Eddie and his sister Sue are vacationing in London, England, when they become lost in a medieval torture chamber called Terror Tower and have to run from the Lord High Executioner. Things get weirder when they begin losing their money and their memories. You know, of losing money and memories, one is a lot more concerning. Money being a physical object you could just sort of lose, memories indicating a brain problem. Although I guess you probably see a lot in both in casinos, seniors who are losing their money and memories bit by bit. The Cuckoo Clock of Doom, number 28. To get back at his bratty sister Tara for ruining his party, Michael vandalizes his father's new cuckoo clock by twisting the bird's head backwards so Tara will get blamed for it. His plan backfires when he finds himself reliving his disastrous birthday party and goes back in time every time he goes to sleep. Who gets a new cuckoo clock? Can that even be had? Okay, I just looked it up on Amazon, and you can buy a new cuckoo clock. And not just like modern stupid minimalist ones. Clocks made of wood with shit that looks like pine cones all over it. 29. Monster Blood 3. In this third installment of the Monster Blood books, Evan Ross accidentally ingests some of the evil green slime after his nerdy cousin Kermit uses it in a chemistry experiment and grows into a giant. Well, we went from accidentally feeding it to the hamster to just straight up eating it himself. But again, I'm in the same spot where I can't call him too stupid without calling myself stupid. I thought slimes I saw online were edible, and I just looked up some more slimes, and I found a website where they had slimes. They described them as butter slimes, said they were spreadable, said they smelled delicious. All of them are named after foods, and then after a ton of looking around, I did find they also are not edible. I mean, I can't be the only one who thinks some slimes are edible, right? 30. It Came From Beneath the Sink. Katrina and her brother Daniel find a living sponge underneath the sink in their new house that turns out to be a monster called a gruel that causes bad luck for anyone who finds it. A monster that causes bad luck for anyone who finds it, huh? R.L. Stine is writing my memoirs now? 31. Night of the Living Dummy 2. Amy Kramer gets a replacement ventriloquist dummy named Slappy, which she accidentally brings to life by reading a spell from his coat pocket. Hey, note to parents out there, when your kids outgrow their creepy dolls and you donate them to Goodwill or whatever, go ahead and put a weird spell in their pockets. Just make the world a little more interesting, if you would. 32. The Barking Ghost. Cooper Holmes and his new friend Fergie, Fergalicious, are stalked by two ghost dogs who haunt the woods and produce a bone-chilling bark. Arl Stein said this was also one of his least favorite books, along with Go Eat Worms. Maybe he turned it into two dogs because it wasn't working, and he figured, well, I'll just double up the dogs. Everything might work out. It's honestly not the worst idea. Book not working? Just double whatever the threat is. The Horror at Camp Jelly Jam, 33. While on a road trip with their parents, Wendy and her brother Elliot get inside their parents' trailer and crash into a sports camp called King Jelly Jam Sports Camp. The two decide to stay and participate in the activities until their parents can come for them, but while Elliot is enjoying the competitive spirit, Wendy finds it all too bizarre, especially when the winners end up missing, one of the counselors survives a bone-crushing hit to his chest, everyone is disappointed in Wendy, who is not sharing their obsessive competitive spirit, and the ground begins to shake at night. You know, ending up in a sports camp is a nightmare to begin with. You don't really need to take it any further than that. Especially because if I ended up in a sports camp, it wouldn't be like a movie where the jocks ended up liking me and sort of adopting me even as a mascot. My best hope would be it would end up with me not being made fun of constantly, just sort of ignored, and then when we were all back in school together, we could just all pretend like we'd never met. 34. Revenge of the Lawn Gnomes. Joe Burton's father, Mr. Burton, buys two garden gnomes named Hap and Chip. But Joe and his sister Mindy discover that the garden gnomes were alive and caused destruction at night. I feel like garden gnomes would be very productive when it comes to destruction. I don't know why, I just feel like they'd be hardworking. It's just unfortunate that their work is to fuck shit up. 35. A Shocker on Shock Street. Aaron Wright and her friend Marty were big friends of a series of horror movies made under the Shock Street banner and are picked by Aaron's father, Mr. Wright, as the first kids to tour his new Shock Street theme park ride. But while the two were on the ride, all the animatronic creatures like the giant praying mantis, Wolf Boy, Wolf Girl, and other creatures start to get out of control and try to kill them. Did R.L. Stein consider any alternative titles? Such as A Street on Shock Shock, or A Streeter on Shock Street, or A Shock on Streeter Street? Am I the only one trying to chew on this word salad and finding it to just be totally random? 36. The Haunted Mask 2. Steve Boswell goes to the mask shop that Carly Beth went to in the first book and buys an old man mask to scare the little kids he's forced to coach in school as punishment for a prank from before, and much like Carly Beth in the first book, Steve finds out that the mask he bought is bent on warping the personality of anyone who wears it for too long. Do you think it's warping the personality of him into an old man? Who are, you know, old men being the real monsters? He starts voting poorly and learning to play chess in the park. This is one of the big reasons I don't think I could retire in Manhattan. I don't like chess, and I think old men are required to play chess in the park, so that when aliens invade or whatever, they can look up and be like, holy shit. 37. The Headless Ghost. The pranksters Dwayne and Stephanie love to visit Hill House, a place said to be haunted by a ghost of a young boy who was decapitated by an evil sea captain. One night, they decide to go to the house after it closes to find the boy's head, but actually end up encountering the Headless Ghost as well as a few other restless spirits. More like a sea decaptain, huh? D-Captain, decapitated. If you were in search of the head and found the ghost body instead, how mad can you be about that? I mean, that's a very solid silver medal at the least. 38. The Abominable Snowman of Pasadena. The Abominable Snowman of Pasadena. Jordan and Nicole Blake were sick of living in Pasadena, California, especially during the winter months where kids in other states get to enjoy snow. The two get their wish when their father, Mr. Blake, is assigned to travel to Alaska to find the Abominable Snowman, but trouble ensues when the Abominable Snowman and his snow, which when thrown can turn anything into ice, is brought back to California. What the fuck is Mr. Blake's job that he's assigned to find the Abominable Snowman in Alaska? Does he work for some kind of eccentric billionaire who's just sending his staff out to bring back cryptids or something? Listen, I've got Johnson on the Loch Ness Monster, Stevens on Bigfoot, Wong on the Wendigo, and you, Blake, are headed to Alaska for that abominable snowman. The more abominable, the better. 39. How I got my shrunken head. Mark, a chubby 12-year-old boy, that seems unnecessary, who prefers the company of video games to actual people, is given a shrunken head by his jungle explorer Aunt Benna's assistant. I mean, maybe Mark's experiences with people giving him things like shrunken heads is part of the problem here. The assistant suggests that Mark be brought down to the jungle island of Baladora to visit his Aunt Benna, but soon discovers that the assistant Dr. Richard Hollins, Carolyn Hollins, and their daughter Corrine are plotting to shake Mark down for information on the jungle magic the shrunken head possesses. Okay, I read up a little bit about shrunken heads. First of all, they do exist. It's a real thing. If you peel the skin off of a head and boil it, it'll shrink down to about the size of a fist, so that's cool. Then I was reading about the efforts to return shrunken heads to the peoples they were taken from, which, well, this feels a little more complicated than returning like a clay pot. Because, I mean, if the shrunken head is authentic, it was taken from an enemy warrior. So, like, does the tribe that had the shrunken head and got it taken from them, do they really own that head? Is it better for them to have it than for a museum to have it? I guess it was in the course of war, but if I found, say, a finger from a Japanese guy that a relative took from World War II, and then a museum came and took it, I don't know if I'd be too hot on trying to claim that that finger was my property. 40. Night of the Living Dummy 3. Trina Odell's father, Mr. Odell, used to be a famous ventriloquist, but now he only collects and refurnishes old ventriloquist dolls in his spare time. That's not weird at all. He finds Slappy in the trash and adds him to his collection. After the reading the words that come with Slappy, not only does the evil dummy come to life, but so does his entire collection. I mean, if you collect ventriloquist dummies, I think you have to accept the risk that they're going to come to life. It's part of the game, baby! You want the fast-paced life of doll collecting? You're going to have to risk getting some evil possessed dolls in the mix. 41. Bad Hair Day. Amateur magician Tim sneaks out to a midnight show held by his idol, Amazo. After Amazo puts Tim in a box, he drops backstage and stumbles upon Amazo's dressing room. Tim steals Amazo's magic bag and finds that Amazo's magic is more than he can handle. Tim needs to work on a better magician name than Amateur Magician Tim. Maybe the Semi-Amazing Tim, the Competent Tim. The Tim who will make good use of your time, won't blow your mind, but you'll ultimately enjoy the show, Tim. 42. Egg Monsters from Mars. During a disastrous Easter egg hunt in the backyard, Dana Johnson finds a strange blue-veined egg and keeps it. When it hatches, Dana discovers a pile of scrambled eggs with eyes known as an egg monster. Dana shows it to a scientist, but the scientist ends up imprisoning Dana with his discovery. Eggs definitely qualify as a food that I'm like, who decided to eat this? I watched a bird poop out this ball, and I'm going to crack this shell and then swallow the slime inside. That's pretty fucked up. I guess I understand eating, say, a lobster, because if it's alive, it's probably got something edible inside, right? But even knowing what we know about eggs, I feel like it's a questionable food stuff. 43. The Beast from the East. Ginger Wald, a former nature camp survivor, and her twin brothers, Nat and Pat, end up lost in the woods where beaver bear-like monsters calling themselves beasts challenge them to a dangerous game of tag called Beast from the East. Nature camp survivor is how this character is described. Is this code for concentration camp? Like, is the concentration camp in the Goosebumps world called that instead? Because I wouldn't call myself a camp survivor having been to a summer camp. It's like calling yourself a vacation survivor, or not a marathon finisher, but a marathon survivor. Say cheese and die. Again! 44. To prove to his English teacher, Mr. Sauer, that the camera he found in the summer is real so he can raise his failing grade on a class assignment, Greg goes back to the abandoned house to retrieve the camera and finds that it still works. But after accidental snapshots, he finds as Sherry becomes skinnier and skinnier, Greg goes fatter and fatter. High school students are such assholes. They would do anything to prove a teacher wrong, even refinding a stupid haunted camera that almost got them killed. 45. Ghost Camp. Harry Altman and his brother, Alex Altman, go to a Camp Spirit Moon, where the campers turn out to be ghosts who want to use Harry and Alex's body to escape. That's reasonable. I mean, couldn't we die at the mall or something instead of some stupid camp? Ooh, or in a movie theater. That would be a great place to be a ghost. When there are good movies, you just watch the movies, and when there are crappy movies, you do ghost stuff. 46. How to Kill a Monster. While at their grandparents' house at Swamp in Georgia, Gretchen and her stepbrother Clark decide to put their differences aside when they find themselves trapped in the house with a swamp monster. It's nice of these kids to stop arguing about whatever the fuck kids argue about long enough to try and not die. I'm trying to remember what sorts of stuff I'd argue with my brother about when we were kids. Probably stuff like what constituted one turn on Nintendo. I feel like we could at least put that aside if we were faced with a seriously dangerous scenario. Like, at least for the duration of that scenario. I'm not saying we'd get along famously forever, but for that day, I think we'd be cool. 47. Legend of the Lost Legend. Marissa and Justin, the kids of the famous writer and storyteller Richard Clark, decide to help their father find an ancient parchment called The Lost Legend, and soon find themselves in the wood of Brovania. That sounds like a gym. Home to silver-coated dogs, thousands of mice, and Vikings thought to have been dead long ago. So, is the parchment called The Lost Legend? Which, does that mean it was written and then lost on purpose? But also, a country being home to thousands of mice doesn't seem that impressive. The estimate of rats in New York City is 3 million. If anything, maybe I'm supposed to be concerned because, you know, thousands of mice seems like a relatively small number, and I should be wondering, what happened to all those little mousies? 48. Attack of the Jack-O-Lanterns. To get payback on two bad kids who always ruin her Halloween, Drew and her friend Walker recruit the help of twins Shane and Shana, but instead of the twins, two pumpkin-headed monsters appear and force all four of them to trick-or-treat all night so they can be fattened up for eating. I mean, if I'm going to be killed by a supernatural beast, trick-or-treating like mad and eating all the candy is how I want to go out. Okay? Even today at age 40. If I was 12, I might be inclined to go for that like as a deal, like to agree to it as a business proposition. There's a downside, death and all, but there's a definite upside. 49. Vampire Breath. During an air hockey game, Freddy and his best friend Kara accidentally knock over a china cabinet and find a secret room housing a coffin and a bottle labeled Vampire Breath, which brings to life vampire named Count Nightwing in search of his fanged dentures. Alright, that's legitimately funny. I need my vampire dentures before I can go on my reign of terror. A+. 50. Calling All Creeps. After getting kicked off the school newspaper club, Ricky pulls a prank on newspaper head Tasha by putting a message for all creeps to call Tasha after midnight in the next issue of the school paper. However, Tasha shows that she is wise to his trick, probably because she works on the school newspaper, and puts Ricky's name in the message instead, leading to Ricky being stalked by lizard-like creatures posing as the school's bullies who'd need Ricky to plant metamorphosis seeds to enslave all of humanity. That prank took a hard turn at the end. I'm just going to say that one could, not me, but let's say you worked with someone you really disliked, and every time something came up where you had to add an email to a mailing list, you could use that person's email instead of your own. That's a thing someone could do that kind of feels similar to calling all creeps. Beware the Snowman. After her mother died, Jacqueline and her Aunt Greta moved from Chicago to an Arctic Circle town called Sherpia, where everyone lives in fear of an evil monster disguised as a snowman living in the mountains. When Jacqueline goes searching for it, she finds that the snowman knows about her missing father and her dead mother's secret hobbies. You know, I think people who live in Chicago would shrug and be like, what's the diff? Frozen tundra is what Chicago does like 9 months out of the year anyway. At least they have hot dogs there, though. 52. How I Learned to Fly. To one-up his rival Wilson and win the heart of his crush, Mia, Jack Johnson finds a book that teaches people to fly, but soon finds out that Wilson has also learned how to fly, and after stunning everyone with a race, the two become reluctant celebrities. You know, I think as a human, anyone would be impressed by flight. But romantically, I'm not sure that flight would convince me to be in a relationship with someone. Like, if it was someone I wasn't into before, and then they were like, oh yeah, watch this, and flew around a bit, I would be stunned. But I don't think that translates to romance. However, these are like middle schoolers, so I can kind of see it. I mean, middle school boys offer almost nothing, so flight would put you on at least some level. 53. Chicken. The farm girl Crystal and her brother Cole find themselves out of luck when a mysterious woman in black named Vanessa shrieks, chicken, after the two accidentally knock her down in front of a grocery store while walking home, and the siblings begin growing feathers and beaks. So thinner, but chicken instead. I suppose I'd rather be thinner than a chicken man. Given these two options thus far, I feel like there are probably others on the table. These mysterious curse women really should give you a menu of options. You're going to turn me into something. None of them are good, but can't you at least give me a choice? I mean, my body, my choice, right? That's what that means? 54. Don't go to sleep. Despite his mother's admonitions, Matt spends the night in the empty guest room of his house and ends up waking up in a new world and on the run from a police force bent on stopping those who warp reality. So wait, what? He warps reality by sleeping in an empty guest room. This feels like how you would warp reality, though, by doing something very minor that wouldn't have any effect whatsoever, you would think, right? You pick a certain bag of chips off the shelf, turn left instead of right to put them in your shopping cart, and boom, you're in another dimension, which probably involves Hitler in some way. That seems to be what it always involves. 55. The blob that ate everyone. The aspiring writer Zach is given a typewriter. You know, I'm going to give props to R.L. Stine for resisting a writer character until 55. He's given a typewriter and a pen by a woman whose shop was destroyed in a lightning storm. The typewriter is just what Zach needs to finish his story about a mysterious blob, but Zach and his best friend Alex soon discover that life has a horrifying way of imitating art. I read in R.L. Stine's, like, memoir that he types all of his book with his pointer fingers. This has stuck with me for some reason. I guess because it's weird and funny. I wonder if R.L. Stine had known what his career would look like if he would have gone ahead and learned to type faster at some point. You know what I mean? If he was like, I'm still going to be doing this in, you know, several decades. He probably would save years of his life at this point. The Curse of Camp Cold Lake, number 56. Sarah Mass hates Camp Cold Lake because of the apathetic campers and the myriad safety rules, so she pretends to drown herself to win friends. Unfortunately, the plan backfires. Who could have seen that coming? When Sarah has a near-death experience and meets a ghost girl named Della, who will stop at nothing to make Sarah her friend in the afterlife, even if it means killing her. I'm going to assume this bid to win friends is explained in more detail in the book, because I'm not totally sure how this works. I guess I haven't made a friend in, like, decades, so maybe I'm the fool here and should throw myself in front of a bus or something. My best friend is invisible, 57. After visiting an abandoned house said to be haunted, Sammy Jacobs soon gets a new friend, a boy named Brent, who no one, not even Sammy, can see. Based on the description, it's possible this is an allegory about race or something, but I'm pretty sure it's just going to be a ghostie. 58. Deep Trouble 2. Billy and his sister Sheena Deep were back on summer vacation with their uncle Dr. George Deep in the Caribbean. When the two go swimming, they discover an evil plot to breed mutant sea life and end world hunger. Well, that doesn't seem so bad. But I mean, having a story called Deep Trouble 2 starring someone named Sheena Deep, that sounds very adult if you know what I mean. And you do know what I mean. I know you know. I'm winking. If you can hear that, that's the sound of me winking like mad. 59. The Haunted School. During a dance at his new school, Tommy Frazier and his new best friend Ben go into an elevator in search of banner paper and find themselves in a black and white world where most of the school's missing class of 1947 now resides, thanks to an evil photographer named Mr. Chameleon's magic camera, while the rest of them have descended into madness and started a cult bent on ridding the world of color. There's a lot going on here. I wonder if Stine knew the series was ending and was like, fuck it, I'm going to clear the docket of ideas. Haunted camera, time travel, sucking the color out of the world, cults, all of it madness. I kind of love it, though. Like, it seems like easily enough story for 120 pages. 60. Werewolf Skin. Aspiring photographer Alex goes in search of werewolves in his aunt and uncle's small town and discovers that these werewolves are closer to him than they think. What is it with movies and books thinking kids are aspiring photographers? I never knew a single kid who was an aspiring photographer. I knew kids who aspired to drink Mountain Dew and jump on trampolines. 61. I live in your basement. Sick of his overproductive mother keeping him from having fun, Marco sneaks off to play baseball and gets hit in the head. While recuperating at home, Marco begins getting strange calls from someone named Keith, who wants someone to take care of him, and the more Keith is around Marco, the more Marco's reality becomes warped. You know, Stein's most horrifying scene was in Say Cheese and Die, and when that kid gets hit in the head with a baseball, that was the most frightening thing I read this whole month. It's good enough that I'll allow a repeat of getting hit in the head with a baseball. I don't know if I care about the rest of this book, but it's a damn good start. It would be hilarious to, next time I get hit in the head, introduce a new person into my life and pretend like we were best friends or something, a Keith, if you will. If anyone wants to do that to me, / for me, I'm giving you pre-permission. Monster Blood 4, number 62. Evan, Andy, Kermit, and Conan once again battle the monstrous slime, but they soon discover that this monster blood is an excessively thirsty, purplish-blue slug-like creature that can multiply by feeding on water. At this point, I blame the slime. These kids have successfully fought off slime 3 times, so why not just attack some different kids who are less capable, you know what I mean? Like, if there was a Gremlins 3, wouldn't the Gremlins come after someone who wasn't Billy Peltzer? That'd be the smart move. Although I guess Gremlins are just creatures of chaos, so not so much strategy. Maybe slimes are also not strategic in any way other than trying to get me to think they're food and eat them. Well, that does it for this year's Potoween, everybody. Unless, of course, you're subscribed to my Patreon, where I'm going to share my 10 Goosebumps book ideas. It's behind the paywall because I think it's embarrassing to pretend I'm on R.L. Stein's level. I close the month with the huge respect for R.L. Stein. He seems like a genuinely nice guy, he seems to really enjoy entertaining young people, and I think he enjoys doing what he does. I mean, my boy's a millionaire and he still writes. One of the things I like in the realm of books is books that gets people who might normally not read to become readers, even if it's just for a book or two. I think Stein has probably done that for a lot more people than just about anyone else. And when I was reading his How to Write book, he said that he liked writing Goosebumps where the kids are punks or don't learn a lesson because adults can read books that are just for funsies and kids have the same right. And I did really love that. R.L. Stein has done a really great thing for the world. And even though I poked some fun at Goosebumps this month, it is all with love. And because this is Helpful Snowman, here's my recommendation. Goosebumps books are great to read while you're on the crapper. Seriously, the chapters are short, you can keep track of the stories pretty easily, they're simple enough. As another book pointed out, everyone destroys the bowl now and then, so if you're looking for a little entertainment while you lighten your load, I can't recommend Goosebumps enough. This might not sound like a very good endorsement, but I assure you, from this podcast, from this host, it's the highest of praise to say these are good to read while you take a dump. Thanks for being with me this October. All right, everybody. Well, it's, what is it, October 30th? And today we have a very special show. They're all special in their own way. Can you tell I'm already off script on this one? Because I'm like hurriedly trying to open up a tab. Okay. Today, what we have is some favorite reviews of mine of Goosebumps books. There are many, many wonderful reviews of Goosebumps with a lot of nice things to say, and I'm not going to read any of those. And instead, I'm going to find what I'm calling some of the best reviews that I could find. Now, you know, that's obviously subject to some, you know, debate. But here we go. This is a review of A Night in Terror Tower by Unknown. 1 star, sticks. I think they probably meant to type sucks, but somehow typed sticks? Unsure. This book is, (1*). I guess that means 1 star. Because it isn't scary or interesting, so now I will tell you that you should not read this book and spend money. By (Lucas). There's things I like more. I mean, pizza exists, but I deeply enjoy when people sign, you know, their Amazon reviews and things like that. You know, it just, it tickles me, as it should you. Let's see, Jeff Carlson reviewed Attack of the Mutant. 3 stars, inferior product is the headline. And the book, the review is, this book is an excellent read. So, inferior product, but the book is an excellent read. Perhaps what happened here is Jeff Carlson got like a crappy copy or something. I don't know if a lot of the Goosebumps have been remade as like, I don't know what they're calling them, classic Goosebumps or something. And they renumbered them and have different covers. So maybe the product is inferior, but the book itself is an excellent read. Jeff Carlson is a potentially a discerning man or potentially very stupid. I'm not going to tell you which way I lean. You know, I don't want this to turn into the I Hate Jeff Carlson show. That's a different podcast that I'm planning. All right, Sam reviewed Curse of the Mummy's Tomb. 5 stars, summer read. This was a great choice for my tutor student over summer. We used it as a text for learning about the Great Pyramid. Oh, no. There are lots of good things to say about Goosebumps and Curse of the Mummy's Tomb and like, okay, when this review starts and says this was a great choice for my tutor student over the summer, I was like, oh, yeah, like if you're a reading tutor and you're like, oh, I finally found a fucking book this kid will read. But as far as curriculum for learning about the Great Pyramid, I didn't read Curse of the Mummy's Tomb this year. I mean, I read that as a child and I remember it being scary and they were like lost in a pyramid that seemed very Indiana Jones. More the mummy than, you know, the Usborn Book of Mummies or whatever. I'm questioning your tutoring skills, Sam. I'm not sure. Okay, General Zombie reviewed Deep Trouble, which has a shark on the cover. 1 star, it's about frickin' mermaids. I remember when I was little and I liked Goosebumps' books and there was a new one and it had a shark on it and it was gonna be sweet, because I liked sharks too. But then I read it and it was about frickin' mermaids. I was so pissed off. In fact, thinking about it now, I'm still pissed off. This is probably a pain that General Zombie has been carrying for at least 10 years. A decade of pain. I kind of, you know, want to shit on it because I'm like, well, who cares if it's about mermaids instead of sharks? Because to be honest, not a ton of like evil mermaid fiction out there. I know there's some, but compared to evil shark fiction, and evil mermaid fiction, in my opinion, is probably more interesting. Because like evil shark is sort of like, well, it peaked at Deep Blue Sea when they were like, so we were doing like Alzheimer's research, and in order to do that, we had to basically give sharks steroids and make their brains 10 times smarter. And you're like, okay, no one thought there might be a problem with that. Also, we made them more aggressive and gave them machine guns. That's when it peaked for me. But you know, like sharks, I'm like, I don't know how far you go. And the other thing is, I think like the first shark thing that everyone thinks of as Jaws, and it was good. Like, it's that's the definitive shark thing. So, you know, like, let, I don't know. Do we need, how many sharks attacking people do we need? You know what I mean? Give me a mermaid. That would be a good, actually, I would enjoy a movie where it was like, it looked like we were getting a shark attack movie, and then it turned out to be a mermaid attack. That would be pretty great. Okay, Go Eat Worms was reviewed by Fruity Girl. 2 stars, Go Eat Worms is the headline. Okay. Yuck. Well, it was so boring book, sorry, but I hate H8. Worms, gross stuff like dat. Just wasted my money and time reading that book. Oh, book. B-U-K, book. But R-E-A-L-L-I, if you like L-Y-K worms, I think you will like it. I can't tell if the Fruity Girl is like writing a, you know, like, is this like a literary, is this, are we watching a, oh man, what's that guy's name? He wrote that memoir supposedly by death that has words in it that I can't say. Anyway, is Fruity Girl a literary genius who's like taking on this persona? Or is Fruity Girl, is this really what this person thinks? This is a good example too of sometimes a book, you know, like by reading a bunch of the reviews, there's someone who reviewed a story that I wrote. And the person was like, he should have focused more on character development and less on the gore. And when I read something like that about a book, I'm like, well, this is the book for me. You know what I mean? Because I'm like, this isn't a positive review, but the thing that they didn't like about it is something that I'm like, I don't need character development in a 10-page short story. Give me some gore. I'm into it. All right, let's see. This is of The Haunted Mask. I'm going to do my best to read this phonetically. 1 star, WWW worst story ever, thumbs down, thumbs down, thumbs down. Nast bok so ugly, nor even scary. Forgivey, kagigini, higikik, hovjabub, hinimajum, thvivum, babunum. I fucknit need no more wires, batijich. So, a couple things could have happened here. I'm going to share with you some theories. You know, Amazon became sentient on November 1st, 2017, when this review happened. And we're witnessing the nascent first words of Amazon's artificial intelligence. Or, you know, some dummy sat on his keyboard and basically typed this out. Or maybe this was an orally dictated thing. I fucking need no more wires, but did you? And, you know, it was trying to understand him, and that's the best it could do. Any way you slice it, it's funny to me when someone is like, this is the worst story ever, and then their review is like, not even something I can comprehend. It just makes me wonder, like, how qualified are you to, you know, evaluate the worst story ever? I'm not sure. I'm not so sure. All right, here's a review from Grimm of Let's Get Invisible. 3 stars, it was okay. I really liked the ending of this one, but overall it was a bit repetitive, and I had to slog through the rest to get there. The ending saved it from being a 2-star, honestly. The writing wasn't bad, especially compared to other Goosebumps that I've read, but there was one phrase that was boggling my mind the whole time. Get invisible. Not turn invisible, or be invisible, or become invisible. Get invisible. I've never heard get used with invisible before, especially not in the sentences this phrase was used in. It was really pulling me away from the story because I squinted every time it was used. I don't know if it was a tongue-in-cheek move to quote the title, which also doesn't make sense, or what, but it was driving me bonkers. There was also a retcon in the middle of the story. The way the kids use the mirror. I couldn't unsee the retcon throughout the rest of the story, but that seems to happen a lot in these stories. The solution being right there in the kids' hands, and then they completely blank it out as a solution. I mean, if the phrase let's get invisible is a problem for you, I don't think Goosebumps are your speed, my friend. You know what I mean? Like, if you're like a grammar person who's like, I don't know, bad grammar throws me, or like kid lingo I don't understand or whatever. Let's get invisible, baby. Let's get invisible. Visible. Ta-na-na. Ta-na-na. Na-na-na. Ta-na-na. Okay. This is also a review from Grimm for Monster Blood. How is this the same person? I got two reviews from the same person and didn't even realize it. 2 stars disappointing for Monster Blood. First and foremost, there's continuity problems with this one. It did not make sense after what we learned in the first one. Heck, it didn't make sense that it even continued or what a twist is at the end of this one. Doesn't make sense that there's going to be more Monster Bloods in the future either. I don't know if Stein was encouraged to make more and retcon some things in the first one or what, but it bothered me that certain things were ignored. There's also nothing spooky about this story, just kids being dumb. Andy is acting different than the first book, and naturally there's yet another bully Evan has to deal with. This was more about bullies and troubles at a new school than it really had anything to do with Monster Blood, and when it did get around to that part, I was already annoyed and already squinting at the illogical reasoning for Monster Blood being back to enjoy it. The only reason why I'm giving it 2 stars is for certain scenes I enjoyed, if I ignore the logistics of it. Real shame about the Monster Blood series. I feel like my star rating will continue to drop for the next ones. Good thing I'm taking a break from Monster Blood to read Say Cheese and Die instead. Grimm is really caught up in continuity and, you know, all that stuff, which is, this is like classic nerd stuff. You know, people don't really probably remember the days of, you know, at a Comic-Con, would be like, okay, I would read Wizard, the comics magazine, and people would write in letters to Wizard, and the Wizard, you know, it'd be like a gotcha letter, and it would be like, excuse me, or like into the letters pages at Marvel, right? And they'd be like, how can Wolverine in Uncanny X-Men 345 be in outer space when in Wolverine number 27, which came out the same month, he's clearly on Earth in Japan? And, you know, it would just be like, they would try and sort of answer it and not, you know, alienate a fan while also just sort of, you could tell they're dying inside. You know what I mean? That they're just like, oh my God, shut the fuck up. Could you just shut the fuck up? Like, nobody cares about that. You know what I mean? That's not really a question. Also, I find it interesting that Grimm is always like squinting when they are, they're like, I'm not enjoying this story. I'm going to begin my squinting, which is my disapproval. Okay, then we've got 2 reviews of My Hairiest Adventure. Manoj Kumar, 1 star, waste of time and money. This is a very bad book. I feel head pain when I see / read this book. One person found this helpful, by the way. One person found it helpful that Manoj was like, it hurts me when I see this book. Just when I see it on my shelf, it hurts my head. Manoj, if you're out there, maybe see a doctor. You know what I mean? It could be that you're just making an amusing thing. But if your head does actually hurt when you see this object, do it. V. Sivaraman says 1 star, rejected book. Rejected book, some page collapsed to binding. Total book is scraped book. Yep, pretty deep there. It's one of the things that bothers me about Amazon. Okay, if you order a pair of headphones and they're of terrible quality, please tell me about it. You know what I mean? Or if they arrive broken. But when you get a book, the review, I think, should be about the book, not the quality of the object, unless the book is of such a problematic quality. You know, I got an ebook once that was like a self-pub ebook, and the formatting of it was wrong, so it was like the words were running together and the paragraph breaks were fucked up. It was fucked up, and it was pretty unreadable. So feel free if it's like that to do that. But when you're like, it came damaged in the box, you know what I mean? The box was underwater and then delivered to my house. It's like, I mean, that doesn't really help me as a reader of this unless I have suspicions that it's going to be submerged. And I'll give you an example. I order these big tubs of Gatorade powder from Amazon. And one time it came and the tub had come open at some point in the, you know, whatever, and the whole box was filled with Gatorade powder. And I was like, well, this is not usable. And it was kind of a faff to, like, go back through and explain to them, like, what was wrong. And then, because normally they're like, we don't give refunds on this product. And I was like, I understand, but it showed up to me in an unusable form. And eventually it was all fine. But I wouldn't review that item poorly for that happening one time. You know what I mean? Night of the Living Dummy. The Camden gives it one review with the headline, bad. Poor.ly.done and not... That's a great website for me. Poor.ly.done. And not good for a 10-year-old girl. Creepy and not my type. Top of the world bad, said my 10-year-old. I love that phrase. Top of the world bad. That's, I guess, a way of saying something's bad. You know, like it's... Of all the things in the world, this is the top bad. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what that means. It seems like a phrase a 10-year-old would use in their house, and it just becomes accepted lingo in their house. But then they use it outside the house, and everyone's like, what the fuck are you talking about? But three people found this helpful. Dennis McLaughlin, one star was his review, and the text one star was the headline. The plot is predictable and not recommended for children. Dennis McLaughlin. He's got to sign it. I mean, to be fair, his username left off the N at the end of his name, so maybe he did feel like he needed to sign it. Maybe that's fair. Like, the plot is predictable. I mean, it is a Goosebumps book that's for children, so I would say many of the plots of these are fairly predictable. Ron John Das reviewing Piano Lessons Can Be Murder. Three stars, such a weird plot. I would have rated it 2 if I wouldn't have fallen in love with Jerry. Story begins pretty well with Jerry's new home along with his haunted piano. Everything was going well till Dr. Shriek came and turned the story into nothing more than pure shit. With asterisks. I am sorry for my language, you know, he's asterisks, I guess. But how could I endure the shit? Sorry for my language, but then I'm going to use the same word again. How could I endure the shit that ruined such a wonderful story? Thank you. I loved Jerry. I loved the character in this book. But what a stupid plot. It was shit. Pure shit. Saved by a good character. I'm trying to think of, like... I don't know if I can see... Like, I'm trying to think of a movie that I felt that way about. That I was like, the plot was so bad and I hated it, but one character was amazing. And kind of saved it to a 3 out of 5 for me. I don't think it's salvageable to 3 out of 5 level for me. If, like, a character is, you know... really good. I don't think that's going to cut it. But, you know, maybe I'm different. I don't know. Maybe somebody is like, Dracula 2000, man. Yeah, Dracula in that movie is so great. Movie sucks, but he's great. This is a review of Scarecrow Walks at Midnight by P. Diddles. Oh, my God. Okay. This is from 2001, too. It's like, they knew. One star... Night of the Mummy's Tomb was great. I love this book. R.L. Stinney did a super job. He should write other books besides this one. He'd be really successful and good. I liked the part where Angela and her sister Nan cut open the turkey. I was so scared. Bad Angela, bad girl, you deserve a spanking. And so does everyone else who doesn't read this book. Attack of the Living Sink 3 is the best noose pumps book I have ever read. I hope she writes a sequel, especially the part when Maxine and Tyler were sneaking around in the museum and the werewolf jumped out and ate their brains. But it turned out Maxine was an alien and Tyler was an invisible vampire whose fangs hadn't grown in yet. This is the best ending. I highly recommend this bookster. That has to be fake, right? News pumps. I now want to make another piece of merchandise that's news pumps. Da, 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 da. Here's a Welcome to Camp Nightmare review from AL. 2 stars, daughter was not impressed. My daughter is a huge R.L. Stine fan. She loves Goosebumps. Her comments on this book was, it wasn't very good, it's pretty boring. I recently bought this book for her. She has put it in the box to give away to friends of the library. Oh, that's how you know it's a piece of shit. We'll give this to the fucking library. That's how much I hate it. My daughter doesn't depart with her books very often. I would hope so. I would think she would part with them more often. I am sure there are other children who will love this book. My daughter isn't one of them. She has many Goosebumps books as well as R.L. Stein books. My daughter wasn't impressed. It's funny, like, I don't know, amateur reviews are such a funny thing, right? Because, like, you can't really tell. I think the thing that a lot of amateur reviewers miss is, like, well, if you're saying, like, I didn't like it, that doesn't really give me any information as another reader, right? Because it's like, well, why didn't you like it? You know, when someone's, like, focus on the characters more, tone down the gore, I'm like, okay, I know why they didn't like it, and I know whether or not that is important to me. But when it's just like, didn't like it, you know what I mean? It would be sort of like if you were on a dating app and, you know, pulled up someone and they looked nice and had, like, seemed like a good life, and they were like, there were quote unquote reviews, and it was just like, didn't like her. And you're like, okay, but it would be helpful for me to know why. Because, you know, maybe you didn't like her because it's like, well, our politics, you know what I mean? I don't know. This is You Can't Scare Me, review by Christina Marshall, 1 star, bad book. I, space, paragraph, paragraph, was not scary at all, so it sucks. I'm a writer myself. For your next book, write something so scary my eye will bleed and give my nightmares, and I'm 27. I don't eat much, so I'm very skinny. I have green eyes and long, long blonde hair. Did this turn into Christina Marshall trying to, like, catfish me halfway through and trying to do it by saying, like, I'm 27 and I don't eat much, so I'm very skinny? I mean, even if you're trying to catfish me, even if you're trying to get me on the, you know, level of, like, I'm very slim, I'm like, I don't really need to know that you don't eat much and that's why you're skinny. Actually, that's not great. That's not my number one, is like, oh, she doesn't eat much. That'll be a lot cheaper when we go out to fucking Chipotle, I guess.
Goosebumps. Reader beware, you're in for a scare.